the road must have a code that you can live by, and so become yourself, because the past is just a goodbye. Teach your children well. Their father's hell did slowly go by, and feed them on your dreams, the one they picked, the one you know by.
Hello and welcome to the July 19th edition of Education Now. In this radio podcast, we welcome Scott Boltman, author, toy manufacturer, and the former director of the Froebel Foundation USA. Our focus is Scott's work at integrating the original Froebel kindergarten method into modern educational environments, and Froebel USA's national conference to be held in San Francisco, California, August 4th and 5th. Scott Boltman believes Froebel's method is entering a new cycle of interest due to a recent focus on K-12 design education and returning play and creativity to the classroom. Froebel is the gold standard of early childhood education and combines the splinter methods of Montessori, Waldorf, and Ruggio into more than the sum of the parts. With strong historical anecdotal evidence from the careers of Frank Lloyd Wright, Buckminster Fuller, and others, the Froebel method is now being used in the graduate school level in design education. The jobs of the 21st century will require ever-increasing visual literacy and competency in geometry. With the new STEM initiative, Scott believes the Froebel method is worth a second look. Froebel's great insight was to recognize the importance of the activity of the child in learning. He coined the term kindergarten and introduced the concept of free work. Activities in the first kindergarten included singing, dancing, gardening, and self-directed play with the Froebel gifts. Scott was born and raised in Grand Rapids, Michigan. He developed an early interest in computers, and his passion for music took over in high school. He graduated from the University of Michigan with a dual major in music composition and film video. He and his family live on the 4 acres remaining of an apple orchard established before the Civil War. They have a farmhouse, 2 barns, a windmill, an outhouse, a garden, and some very old fruit trees. He says it's like a modern version of Green Acres, and they try to have the best of both rural and suburban living. And now, we'll go to the interview, and then I'll be back to talk to you about registering for the Froebel USA Conference. Enjoy. Hello, Scott Boltman, and welcome to Education Now. I've told the listeners in the introduction that you're an author, a toy manufacturer, and the former director of the Froebel Foundation USA, and that you will host this year's Froebel USA Conference, being held in San Francisco on August 4th and 5th of this year.
Yep, that's right.
Yeah.
We're looking forward to it. It's exciting to be in San Francisco. We've had conferences before, but a lot of the West Coast people were reluctant to make the trip to the Midwest or the East Coast, so we're glad to be able to bring the party to you.
I think it's wonderful that you're coming. I'm very excited. I understand that you've worked actively to promote Froebel in kindergarten method internationally since 1997. Is that right?
Yep, that's right. Yep, I've traveled quite a bit. I've been to Europe a couple of times, to Germany, to the UK, and also a couple of trips to South Korea, where a lot of the Froebel activity is centered at this point. There seems to be a large interest in Asia, Singapore, Taiwan, Japan, South Korea, and a growing interest in China.
Isn't that amazing? I mean, I think it's so exciting that in China they're concerned about the whole child and freedom of the child's spirit and following the child. And here in America, we're just seem to be going in an opposite direction, at least in public schools.
Yes, and the interesting thing about the Asian cultures, they've always been focused on academic performance. There's it's a class-based society. So, for instance, in South Korea, there's a lot of bowing based on your perceived position in society. When I traveled there, people would bow to me as though, because I was a business owner, I was on the upper end of society. So the idea is the only way to move up is to either acquire wealth or through academic means gain some prestige. And so there's an emphasis on education there. And what I find interesting is it's a very practical situation. They don't care what it is as long as it works. And what I'm finding is the Asian cultures are realizing that to compete now globally, they need to make sure that their children are focused not only on academic performance but also creativity. And
yes,
they're very open to the Froebel method, to Montessori, to a lot of these child-centered philosophies, because frankly, they see that they're working more efficiently than other means.
Oh yes, well, for me, it's criminal that we don't follow the child, since we know from brain research that confirms Froebel and Montessori. And all of these people who have observed children and came to the conclusion that there's something in the child that if you follow, that child will unfold to its full potential and follow their passion, which is, you know, the goal of humanity, you would think. But
Well, absolutely. It's interesting that in the rest of the world, and including in the United States, Froebel is known among more affluent areas. So, for instance, I've sold to the Cranbrook Institute here in Michigan, the British royal family, and in fact the nanny schools in the UK still use the Froebel method with their children there. The Ibstock School in the University of Surrey campus is where Madonna and Mick Jagger sent their kids, members of Parliament. You know, the British royal family, Prince Charles had a Froebel education. So it's not as though it disappeared among that marketplace for education. But what happened was 100 years ago, at that point, that there had been a large enough bureaucracy of education had been built up that they felt they needed to take us off the Froebel standard and to move it into a system that was a little more manageable. So the idea was is that the turn away from child-centered was more of a turn towards a top-down style of management of education.
Right.
And there were practical reasons for it. It wasn't, I don't vilify the people that were involved in it, but there was a huge demand for early childhood education, and they needed to gain some sense of control over it. But I think they kind of threw the baby out with the bathwater. And if they would have been able to see 100 years in the future to where we're at now, where we're teaching standardized tests to kindergartners, I think they would be horrified at what they had set in motion. But that's essentially what happened, is when they took us off the Froebel standard, it was very much a coup. And there were several key publications that came out at the time undermining child-centered education. One of the people involved was William Hurt Kilpatrick, who was the president of Columbia Teachers College at the time. He wrote two books. One is Froebel Critically Examined, and the other one was Montessori Critically Examined, in which they made their case for why quote-unquote progressive education had to move in the direction it was moving. But essentially that's what happened. And in my process of the Froebel work that I've done, initially they came to me and said, well, you produce the wooden blocks, and we were in the block business, so it was a natural thing for us to do. And then I began to get people coming to me saying, well, okay, I got the blocks, now how do I take full advantage of these? And so I needed to do my research to determine how they were used. And that's when I began to travel and to reach out and connect with people who were Froebelians all over the world, which is what the conference is about. It's a coming together not only in North America, but we draw internationally from Asia and from Europe But the question that ultimately came out was, if we had this 150 years ago, why did we ever get away from it? What could have possibly, you know, got us off track like we had? And that's where the research finally led me to that point about 100 years ago. So, yeah, it's an interesting story.
It is an interesting story. I know we don't want to vilify persons, but when you are responsible, when you are the responsible party for the lives of children, and the research tells you, and all the greatest minds in child growth and development, like Froebel, tell you that you need to follow the child, and you don't. I don't know what could be a greater villain.
I understand, but in my mind, every parent understands. You know that your child wants to spend time with you, and yet you also know that you need to keep a roof over their head and you need to feed them. So you are constantly making these gut-wrenching decisions of, my wife, for instance, works. Every mother, when they go back into the workplace, or not, that you wrestle with that thing. And that's essentially what happened 100 years ago. They were the greats of education. So John Dewey, Hattie Smith Hill, G. Stanley Hall, William Hurt Kilpatrick, they were the ones that moved us off the Froebel standard. And they didn't, in their wildest dreams, think that it would get as bad as it did. They essentially pulled a string and the whole thing unraveled. They just thought they were tidying up and trying to keep things on track. So I don't vilify them. They hold the responsibility for it. But I think ultimately the important thing is that we all are responsible now. As you said, we have brain research now. From the 1980s forward, we know that play is important. We know about child-centered and whole child and all of that. But so now the responsibility lies with us, and what are we going to do? So what I'm trying to do is to keep these materials around, keep the information available. A lot of the materials that we have in our archive are discarded university library books. So we have complete periodicals. We have about 500 volumes. There was a vast amount of literature on Froebel 100 years ago, but almost all of it has been discarded at this point. Mm-hmm. And I'm not talking about junior college libraries. I'm talking about the Stanford Library. I'm talking about the NEA Library. There were, at some point, decisions made about the ability to continue to store volumes that were not being used. Most libraries at that time had to make some tough decisions about space. But now that we have digital storage, and Google actually has been going through what's left of like the entire Stanford Library and digitizing it, so a lot of Froebel books are available in PDF format on Google. In fact, on our website, there's a page. It's froebelusa.com/method. There are about a dozen or more links to free PDFs on the web, and they're listed in roughly about the order that I recommend them. The first few volumes are Froebel, and then there are some other books. So if people are interested, there's a lot of free material that they can access online, and I think that the Internet in particular is part of the reason why there's a resurgence in interest in Froebel. Much more communication going on.
Yes, I'm so glad there's more communication going on, and I really feel like this technology is going to be a boon for us. It can go in the opposite direction, of course, but it's, so far I'm just really happy that this technology exists. And I was introduced to Froebel in my training and as a Montessori teacher in the book by William Crane, Theories of Development. And it just seemed like there was a line of, there was a river of people who were observing children. They didn't even know each other, and yet they all came to the same conclusion from their observation about the need for the child to have movement and how that is connected to the brain development and how there needs to be a childhood or there is no creativity. And, you know, there needs to be play and imagination. And so I am really delighted that you are doing this, and I just really want it to filter into the public system. I know, you know, I was able to do this for my children. I know that if you can afford a Montessori school, or if you live in a certain area, there are lots of public schools who are very conscious of what the kindergarten really is, which is Froebel's phrase, right? He coined that phrase.
Yep, absolutely, yeah. It was a prepared environment. And what's interesting is the misunderstanding, and I think that's really part of the reason why Froebel isn't as widely talked about. I remember I was at a conference, it was probably the ACEI conference when it was in San Diego. A very famous child psychologist stopped by my booth and said, well, it was all very interesting about Froebel and everything, but he really never, you know, he didn't really know what he was doing. He just sort of stumbled upon it, which is not correct at all. And I handed him a book and said, I think you need to read this, because Froebel spent decades observing children and working with Pestalozzi, and, you know, he studied and he read and he observed children, and all this stuff was done very scientifically, to the point where he was able to state, you know, 170, 180 years ago, that birth to three was a critical time period.
Yes.
And because of that, he used to encourage mothers to work with their children, and he provided classes for them to understand things that they can do at that time period, because he recognized that there was a limit to what any type of school could do once children reached that age. And then the kindergarten was more of a community where children would play together and they would be guided by adults, but it was a lot of outdoor play, and it wasn't really structured in that way that we think of kindergarten today. So the term is basically all we have left of the true Froebel approach to education.
Mm-hmm. I feel like I had a very, when I was a child, and I'm approaching 69, I had a fantastic kindergarten that would have reflect Froebel. We did so much singing and dancing and reading books, and we dress up, and the block corner was incredible. And, I you know, it's in my memory to this very day how fantastic it was. And when I go and I observe and I see what some of these children are subjected to in kindergarten, it just makes me want to cry.
Yeah.
Well,
we know the extreme. We know, obviously, the extreme of, you know, a more open, child-centered method. And we've seen what happened in Romania with some of the orphanages where children got almost no human contact.
Right.
So there's a true continuum there, you know, and I feel that what generally happens is people understand what's needed or not needed, but they feel as though there's a trade-off, you know, as far as, you know, we need to have kindergartens be this way because it's a more practical way. We can't possibly afford to give, you know, a class, say, of six children where there might be three adults. You know, that just doesn't seem practical to a lot of people. But then when you look at from a society standpoint, or look at from an educational value. So in Korea, for instance, they really have one major university, Seoul National University, and it's incredibly competitive to get into that school. So you would think if they did it the Western way, you would wait until your child was 16 or 17, then you would get them into a Kaplan test prep course, spend $5,000 or $6,000 trying to raise their SAT scores. What they do in South Korea is they spend $5,000 or $6,000 on early childhood education, because they recognize that birth to three and the 3 to 7 range is really where a lot of that brain development occurs.
That's right.
And they invest their money in early childhood, and I really wish that we would do more of that in North America, that people would understand that, you know, a little bit of extra effort at that time. But even during Froebel's life, people were a little bit suspicious of this play aspect. You know, Froebel did a lot of large muscle games, you know, holding hands and singing and doing a lot of things. He talked about what later became known as multiple intelligences. He talked a lot about birth to three. He introduced, you know, child development toys, educational toys, which were adapted and adopted later by Montessori and other, you know, so attribute blocks, Unifix cubes, Cuisinaire rods, all these things are outgrowths of the materials. What's missing, though, is the integrated way that they were used. And what the conference really allows us to do is to bring trained 4-hour teachers from all over the world and to demonstrate the materials so that people don't have to just look at pictures in a book or, you know, read. They can actually witness how it works because it's an incredibly efficient process. These materials, so the same set of blocks that a 3-year-old will use, they will use those same blocks all the way up to 13 and beyond. And over that 10-plus year period, what will change is the child, not the materials.
Right.
So from a cost-effective standpoint, it's amazing to see where the child begins to recognize things in them, and they keep coming back to the same thing over and over again and discovering new things.
Right.
So it just seems like a very profound way to educate children rather than, say, with Montessori, for instance, which is a wonderful system. I sent my children to Montessori schools. But the cost to tool up, so to speak, on all that material is sometimes daunting. So a lot of good teachers who would like to have a Montessori program just simply can't afford to purchase everything that they need.
Right.
So anyway, these are the things that motivate me about 4-hour education. I feel that it is cost-effective. It's very efficient. It supports the child. It's child-centered. But more importantly, my goal is that I think on a global level now, economically, our children have to compete. And if other countries are adopting this system, their children are going to have a much more creative style education. And that's really what we're left with here in the United States is we're no longer the dominant manufacturing country in the world, but we still dominate when it comes to creative work, whether it be in Hollywood or things like Apple computers, where it's product design, industrial design, which are becoming increasingly more dependent on spatial literacy. There's a lot of graphic design, CAD type work, but also nanotechnology and biotechnology. These are the careers of the future, and creativity is going to be one of the great skills to have. I think we need to have an education that supports that.
Yes, I totally agree with you. You and these, you're going to address these issues at the conference. What you're talking about is with a new STEM initiative that you believe that Froebel method is worth a second look.
Absolutely. In fact, there was one of our presenters at the last conference in 2010, and she'll also be there this time, is Mary Jo Pullman, who's a university professor in Denver, wrote a book on block play, specifically tying it to the NCTM standards on spatial literacy. And I believe this was just at the time when STEM was kind of coalescing. It's now much more widely known. But yes, absolutely, I believe on two different levels. One, the materials certainly are helpful in terms of mathematics and spatial literacy. But also one of the large components of Froebel education is nature education. A lot of outdoor observation of nature, which really brings science into the picture. And so what I usually, when I talk about Froebel education, I point out that Montessori has a lot of the materials, what they now call manipulatives.
Right.
Waldorf, the Steiner schools have the nature education, and that is extremely important. And Reggio Emilia has the project work, the creative work. And when you combine the three of them, you get very, very close to what Froebel education is. I think that the four philosophies, quote unquote, need to work together. And I've spoken at AMS conferences, and a lot of Montessori teachers do purchase Froebel materials for their sensorial shelves.
Yes.
And a lot of Waldorf schools buy them. And so it's not a competition. I think we're all working in the same direction. It's just that sometimes some of these ideologies or methods can get somewhat rigid. I mean, even within Montessori, there are different camps, so to speak.
Right.
But that's really the attraction for me also is it's not a choice of do I send my child to Waldorf or Montessori or Reggio. You can get all of those things together when you look at affordable education. So the conference is really an option to go, and there are Waldorf teachers there who are presenting. There are Montessori teachers there who are presenting. There are affordable trained teachers that are there. And so it's a sharing of ideas and something to connect back with what you said earlier. There is Stacy Wellman, who is a public school teacher in Winnetka, Illinois. She has been incorporating the Froebel method into her public school. They use it in a variety of very innovative ways. In fact, she does literacy assessment using the Froebel materials.
Oh, that's fabulous.
Isn't that great? So that's really the advantage of having these conferences. It's an opportunity to see this in action. It's an opportunity to meet other people who are interested. But really, at its core, it's a chance to share some pretty interesting things that are working in a variety of different settings, whether you're homeschooling, you're a Montessori teacher, you're in a public school. So it's very exciting, and I talk about it a lot as a party because a lot of these people have become friends over the years, and it has a real familiar atmosphere when you're there, a lot of sharing and a lot of positive energy. So
that's wonderful. That's just beautiful. I know that Carmen Gamper, who has been a guest on Education Now twice, is going to be a presenter, right?
Yes, in fact, she's our co-host. I always like to work with somebody locally, and Carmen has that Froebelian spirit. In fact, when we met, she said to me something that was sort of interesting. She said that, you know, she's from Europe, and they know Froebel over there. And when she came here, she was surprised that more people didn't know about Froebel.
Uh-huh.
But she brings with her that ability, the inner method ability. She's Montessori, but she's open to other things and combining it. And she's got a great initiative going, her new learning initiative, and she'll be presenting about that, what she's doing in California.
It just sounds really exciting. Now, let's for our listeners, I want to I will have repeat this information, but the Froebel USA 2012 conference is August 4th and 5th in San Francisco, and it's being held at the South San Francisco Conference Center. Is that right?
That's correct. We'll be there Saturday and Sunday from 8 to 5, but we'll try to go longer. I think we've got some additional time there. And people are welcome to come. If you're unable to come for both days and you'd still like to register, have them just contact me directly, and we'll work something out. And we also do group discounts if people have more than one person that wants to attend.
And so they should, if they go to the website, to your website, to the Froebel website, they will be able to register there?
Yes, you can register online. The conference website is froebelusa.org, so it's froebelusa.org, and there's information there on the speakers, on the hotel accommodations, and you can register online as well.
Yes, and so if they can't do both days and they want to contact you about that or about a discount, there is a way to contact you on the website. Is that right?
Yes, that's right. Yep, there's a way to contact me through the website, and there's I think there's a phone number there too.
Right.
So and the main thing is it's I'm not sure how soon we'll be able to come back to California again. And that's my focus at this point, is anybody on the West Coast who would like to check this out, and now would be the time.
Now's the time. Yes, it sounds very exciting to me. And also, you're going to be having lunches there and breaks, and then you're going to do the closing, right?
That's correct, yep.
You're going to address...
What I usually like to do is kind of sum up and point the direction for next steps. And that's what's been exciting for me, is each time we do a conference, we seem to get everybody that we had last time attending, plus new people. And so there seems to be a building of energy and headed in a positive direction. And we usually talk at that point about, you know, what can we do once the conference is over. There's usually a sense of, oh, our fun is done. You know what it's like when at the end of the day in school and you have to go, you know, you want to stay at school and play, but you have to go home. And,
right.
But you get to come back tomorrow. So that's what we talk about. Where, what are the next steps? Where will the next conference be? That type of thing.
So the Froebel gifts are in the literature, they call them, they're called Froebel gifts. Those are the materials.
Yes, and there is some confusion about that. Froebel numbered the gifts up to number 6 or 7. Six is pretty much what the standard sense is. But Milton Bradley had 20 gifts. And Froebel numbered them essentially because they're difficult to refer to by their description. So gift 3, for instance, is 8 1-inch cubes that combine into one larger 2-inch cube.
Uh-huh.
He just called it gift 3, Spielgabe, play gift.
Uh-huh.
Gift 3, and the idea of calling it gift was that not only was it given to the child so that they would receive it as something given to them, but with a certain amount of respect or reverence. But more importantly, the gift is a tool for discovering the child's gifts, because
yes,
through that process, you can see where the child is at, and it's a really an opportunity for observation more than anything else.
Yeah.
But then once you get to gift 7, which are the surfaces, they call it, or the tablets, what we would call parquetry tiles or attribute blocks, then you can refer to them as what they are. They're tablets. They're parquetry tiles. Gift 8 is sticks or Cuisinaire rods.
Mm-hmm.
And gift what we would consider sticks and rings together because it's a line. And then there's the point. And then gift 10 for us is the framework gift, what you would consider tinker toys or zone tool,
mm-hmm.
those types of things, which brings the series that starts out with gift 1, which is a yarn ball, which is the sphere. And children tend to move towards balls when they're young, when they're very young, because they seem to have a certain amount of life in them. They'll roll.
Mm-hmm.
They're easy to grasp. There's a lot of reasons why children are attracted to balls. But it's a whole form. So Froebel took them from what they know, which is the whole form, moved into individual smaller blocks, then into the surfaces of those blocks, so playing in two dimensions, and then again with line and curve line, which are gift 8, 9 are points, and then bringing it back again full circle with gift 10, which is tinker toys, which is creating representation, abstract representation of space using the point and the line.
Yes.
So it's a very architectural-oriented way of thinking, but it also sets the children up to not only be able to construct and build and create, but it allows them to begin to visualize spaces in terms of points and lines, which is extremely helpful. So there's a lot to talk about in that, but there is some confusion as to what the gifts are. Some people ask me, well, is a gift 3 for a 3-year-old and gift 5 for a 5-year-old? No. They have to be used in that order. No, they don't have to be used in that order. But that's where the problems come in on all this, is once you start to create sort of a system, people are more focused on the system than they are just playing and being creative. And
right,
you have to almost give them permission to break rules that they're the ones that created in their mind.
Yeah.
You know, these are play materials. Play with them. Explore them.
Yeah.
You know, see what you can do with them. And don't be too rigidly stuck on a particular way of delivering.
Right.
You know? So, but it's important to give people permission to have fun. I don't know why it is, if it's culture or what, but sometimes we just really feel like we need to toe the line rather than be creative.
And Victorian upbringing has a powerful hook.
Yes, absolutely. But you know, when you're young, that's the time that you should have that freedom to play and not be so burdened with it. But I have to bring this one thing up, is that and I can't remember his name now, but one of the champions of the homeschool, the unschool movement, John Taylor Gatto, had misunderstood Froebel as being part of the whole schooling process. And that nothing could be further from the truth. He empowered parents to work with their children. It wasn't about taking these young children from their mothers and putting them into some sort of state-sponsored school situation. But that's the impression that somebody has, because they look at these very geometric materials and they think that there's somehow some prescription as to how they're supposed to be used. You know, and it's about taking young children and giving them into the care of somebody else to educate. So So there's a lot of misconceptions that come up. People kind of paint these conspiracies.
Well, the book that Froebel wrote called The Educating Families, is that still available, or is that something, you know?
Well, all of the English translations of Froebel's books, and there were only two books that he authored directly. His manifesto was The Education of Man, and
right.
He wrote that early in his career. And then The Pedagogics of the Kindergarten came much later. And then after he died, a book was published called Education by Development, which he didn't author exactly, but it's a collection of things that he wrote. He had a weekly newspaper that came out on Sunday called the Sonntags Blatt.
The Educating Families,
No, I think you might be thinking of Education of Man, which is...
Oh, no, that's his book. No, I'm talking about the book, the literary work, The Education of Man, but the weekly publication, wasn't that called The Educating Families? Perhaps I'm wrong.
As the Sonntags Blatt, and I don't know. I don't know all of the...
Well, I was just...
Unfortunately, a lot of the great information on Froebel is in German, and I don't speak German much.
Right.
So I'm at a disadvantage in that realm.
Yeah.
So.
Well, I was just thinking when you were saying that, you know, this people who misunderstand Froebel and think that he's saying, you know, let's just take the kids away from the family. I can understand somebody would say that about... Skinner.
Yeah.
But I don't understand how anyone would assume that about Froebel, unless they just have not read.
You know, there's this whole Prussian thing, and a lot of what contributed to getting rid of Froebel was that anti-German sentiment around World War One.
Uh-huh.
You know, we had a city here in Michigan called Berlin, and once World War One occurred, they decided they no longer wanted to be called Berlin anymore, and they switched their name to Marne. And so there was a lot of there's a lot of cultural, historical, economic things that all contributed to this, so I don't want to put too fine a point on it, but there was a very specific decision to try a different approach to early childhood education, and some of it, like with Skinner, falls under some pretty interesting experimental heading. I don't really think you can count that. But I was very interested in the work that Piaget did, because it essentially confirms everything that Froebel talked about. But even then, it wasn't to the level that occurred in the 1980s when we had more neurologic data.
Right.
And now we pretty much know with absolute certainty the impact of play and creativity and all this stuff. So it's surprising that we haven't begun the slow process to get back to where we were 100 and some years ago.
Yeah, this is...
But I'm moving in a direction with what's called design education or design thinking, because the reason why I'm involved in Froebel to begin with has nothing to do with education. It has everything to do with architecture. It was the Frank Lloyd Wright Foundation and Preservation Trust and a lot of the Frank Lloyd Wright shops around the country that knew of Frank Lloyd Wright's love and appreciation for the Froebel method that wanted to sell those materials. They're the ones that came to me and got me interested in it. And it seems to be even today that most of the interest in Froebel is related to design.
Uh-huh.
And that there are some significant connections with design education, including the Bauhaus, which used the Froebel materials to teach design to adults. And many of those artists in the Bauhaus and many of the teachers in the Bauhaus were either in a Froebel kindergarten as a child or received Froebel teacher training. So there's a very strong connection with design and design education with Buckminster Fuller and Paul Klee and Kandansky. So where I'm moving now is to try to stay out of the early childhood fray. There's just too much emotion related to it.
Yes.
To focus on also just saying, look, if we're going to head into this 21st century careers, visual, spatial literacy, let's take a look at the Froebel method as a design education. It has a long, storied history. And so people that are interested, just like Frank Lloyd Wright's mother was, in having their children develop those skills early on, I think should take a look at the Froebel method and the materials for the same reasons.
Yes, I think you're right. The geometry, which is so significant for any kind of design, and that this geometry, when introduced to children at a young age, it has a way of imprinting that when you introduce it later, it just isn't the same. I know in Montessori you introduce, when I did my training, the highest mark you could get was flexible. You know, you're talking about people who were so rigid. But the highest, sure, the highest mark that you could get when you were in training was flexible. Are you flexible? And then that you would introduce geometry in the Montessori classroom before you introduced algebra.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
But in public schools, they don't introduce, you know, they do just the opposite. And so you can see why there's so many people say, oh, I hate math. But I really have not met a child who was in a Montessori environment who has said to me, I hate math.
Absolutely. Well, and the thing is, with Froebel, children 3, 4, 5 years old receive the same design education that I received at university.
Yes.
And they receive it at a time before they have a verbal or a written language.
Yes.
When it can really have an impact. And the same thing is true with geometry and algebra. Algebra is a language.
Yeah.
And a lot of what algebra describes in its language you can see in geometry. So it would make sense to introduce geometry first.
Yes.
And then algebra, the same way that you introduce the visual language to children before the written or the verbal language. So, yeah, absolutely.
Well, I can see that this is going to be a fantastic conference, and you are just a powerhouse of information and very fun to talk to, Scott. I was thinking that it would be true that you would be this involved. I mean, I can see that your family was all involved in education. Is that right? I mean, your mother was...
Yes, my mother was an early childhood educator. She got her master's in early childhood and then started a readiness program here in West Michigan.
Uh-huh.
And was involved in the public schools for many, many years. And my father had a toy manufacturing
business.
Yes. Making alphabet blocks, although I don't know how much Froebel would have approved of alphabet blocks, but it was educational toys. So,
right.
So it was a natural thing for me to continue on both sides of the family business.
Right, it is. And you yourself have developed some educational materials.
Well, yes. I mean, I've innovated some toys. We did some groovy blocks, which are math-oriented, and I developed some Braille alphabet blocks, some different things. And then I've been working most recently with Norman Brosterman, who's got the foremost collection of Froebel materials and wrote a book called Inventing Kindergarten, which has been out of print for a good 6 or 7 years. And we're bringing it back into print this year. We'll have an ebook and then a hardcover available. But he wrote the definitive book on the Froebel Kindergarten. And he and I have been working together on a new toy called the Kaleidograph, which is a very Froebelian-type toy. It's not part of the Froebel materials, but it's a pattern-generating paper toy, very inexpensive. So it's been a lot of fun working with Norman on a variety of projects, the Kaleidograph and his books, and he'll be at the conference as well.
I enjoyed all of your web pages, Scott. The Red Hen Toys website.
Yes. Uh-huh.
I enjoyed the Kaleidograph website. And the whole Movement website was also great. And then Little Orly. Little Orly is a Facebook page. And Froebel USA has also a Facebook page.
Yes, Facebook is a must-have these days, and everything has a regular, like for instance, there's littleorly.com, there's wholemovement.com, kaleidographtoy.com, but then also Facebook, and I like Facebook because it allows the interactions, and I think that's really where the fun is.
Yes, I
so
do too.
Did you know about Little Orly before you found the website?
No,
you know
I didn't.
The history of Little Orly?
I didn't.
Little Orley was created by a man named Lumpy Branham, Hugh Branham, who is probably known to most people as Mr. Green Jeans on the Captain Kangaroo show. But he had a career back in the 30s and 40s. He was a bass player in a jazz group, Fred Waring's Pennsylvanians. And Waring had a radio show on NBC and then later a TV show. And they had sort of a variety hour. And Lumpy did these stories about a little farm kid, a fictional farm kid named Orley, and had these wonderful little fantastical stories. And I grew up listening to the records. They were originally radio shows, radio stories. So they're something that children can listen to and visualize.
Yes.
And so when I started having my own children, I got nostalgic for that. And when I found out they were no longer available, we brought the Little Orley stories back as
that's,
well.
That's so. Just wonderful. One of the reasons that I like doing the radio podcasts rather than having a video component is because I liked listening to the radio myself and learning through that auditory sense so that you have to create the pictures in your mind. Although I love video, I love videos and I love film, there's just something about radio and listening and that I really, really do enjoy. And so it's so really wonderful to hear about Little Orley. When I read that, I was just tickled, so tickled, and I knew that our listeners would be. And then another thing we haven't talked about is your passion for music. You really graduated from the University in Michigan in music, is that right? And video.
Yeah, I studied music composition, and at that time, the only real business for composers was film. So I had a dual major in music composition and film video. Was an interesting term. Most people's lives have some sort of detour in it. I graduated in 88, and it was a recession year. So I started working for my father. I'd been an indentured servant up to that point, but then I actually got an official job working for him. So I worked for my dad for a couple of years until I got a job working for a company that was music-related. And spent a couple of years at that job, and then my father died unexpectedly, so I went back into the toy business again. So I never really got a chance, I thought, to use my education, but now I sort of feel like I get a chance to use all of it, because with the Froebel method, there's an opportunity to incorporate music, especially patterns, because a lot of what happens in Froebel is patterns. There's a lot of music to that, and then I'm hoping to work on some film projects related. I've been doing some short YouTube work, but I would like to do, Norman and I have talked about a Froebel kindergarten documentary.
Oh, that would be fantastic. That would be fantastic.
Absolutely.
Yes.
And he's got the collection to do it. He's got the visual work. If any of your listeners have a chance to see the book, Inventing Kindergarten.
Inventing Kindergarten.
Don't know what I mean.
Okay.
Yeah,
I'll check it out even, Inventing Kindergarten. And if I can find any information on it, I'll post it on Education Now Facebook page so other people can have an opportunity to see it, and on my Google Plus, the Education Now Google Plus page as well, Scott, so that people will have a chance to follow up on that. Well, I know that one of my sons was a music major and is a Montessori teacher, and I, you know, for him they go together really well. And he's never,
absolutely.
And he's never really let go of it. But I had a Montessori school, and we did everything. I mean, I don't think Montessori ever did mythology, psychology. We did mythology, psychology, and
sure.
we did film because we were evolving, and which is, I think, what Montessori would want people to do is to
absolutely.
Evolve and to integrate all of this. I think
absolutely.
That you couldn't be more Montessori than doing what you're doing and integrating the work of all of these people who support one another.
Well, you know, what was interesting back in the early days, the way that it worked with Froebel teachers was you went and studied with somebody, and they watched you and they guided you, you know, and essentially you were learning to observe children. So there was a lot involved in that. And then when you graduated, you got a diploma. But when you would go to get a job as a Froebel kindergarten teacher somewhere, nobody cared about the diploma. They wanted to know who trained you, essentially who signs off on you being a good teacher.
Right.
And that was really all they needed to know. And then they would show you the room, you know, with the materials, and if you need anything, let us know, because you were a skilled practitioner, right?
Right.
You were trusted with children by somebody that they trusted, who had a reputation.
Yes.
And it wasn't micromanagement. It wasn't curriculum and committees and all of that.
No.
At one point, teachers were honored. And if you look at the societies that have the best education system, it would be something like South Korea and Finland and Japan, those are cultures in which teachers are respected. It's very difficult to become a teacher. It's even more difficult to become a teacher trainer in those cultures. But once you achieve that level, you are respected and trusted. Whereas in this country, you know, the whole idea is, well, you're only as good as the test results of the last class that you taught.
Oh, that is so pathetic,
right?
Isn't it? Isn't that pathetic?
But, I mean, that's the problem with No Child Left Behind. And so I guess the thing is nobody's really come out and done, necessarily that I know of, a correlation between the level of trust among teachers. So I would assume that with Montessori is once she trained the people that she would trust them to use what they needed to use and to find new things and to not view what she had done as a necessarily a closed system.
Right.
And so, you know, with Froebel, he only had 6 items that he named as gifts. But then later there were 20 things. Well, those were things that he used in his school. I don't think he really felt like they needed to be numbered as gifts.
Mm-hmm.
If you used them, great. If you didn't, great. If you came up with something else, great. But that's the problem is people want to put numbers on things and they want to be able to lock it down. So I think it's great to find good. When we went to Montessori school, we sent our kids there, not because it was Montessori per se, but because we liked the teachers that were working with our children. If you're going to hand your child off to somebody, you have to like and respect them.
That's right.
And that's what it comes down to, not the building that they're in, anything else.
Right.
Who's going to be spending their day with my child? So, you know, I'd like to see us getting back to more of that, but it's a management issue, and I understand that. So we're kind of caught at a crossroads.
Go ahead.
With music, one of the things that's so interesting is that from the history, and I enjoy the history part of it, some of our people in the past that have presented at our conferences have been ORF trained or Kadai oriented music teachers. And I believe that ORF, Kadai, and Bartok probably all had a Froebel kindergarten education as children. they have that sensibility about them, which isn't to say that they wouldn't have been who they were without it, but I think it definitely helped them. And I think it's a natural fit between, say, ORF and Montessori, or ORF and Froebel.
Uh-huh.
Neither Montessori nor Froebel really had an extensive amount of music as part of their process. They used it, certainly. So I think there's a lot of connections out there that can be. And I hope that teachers feel the freedom to be able to bring those things in as needed. Did you, in your school, have some type of music?
Oh, we did. We had everything. We had, it was, you know, we had dance, we had music, we had mythology, psychology, we had a, you know, it was a fantastic K through 12, and, you know, student-faculty ratio never more than 1 to 12. Well, max 1 to 17, and there were always 2 adults. It was fantastic, and I couldn't be happier. And my children, of course, were all a part of it, and I know when they went on to university, they didn't rush. They didn't hurry up. You know, they wanted to be sure they took, even though, you know, they were, 2 of my sons' major interests were science, 1 physics, 1 biology, but they weren't going to leave out music. They weren't going to stop doing music because they were doing science. They weren't going to stop playing soccer because they were doing music and doing science. You know, this whole idea that, you know, that you stop being a whole human being and you specialize, you know, well, go ahead and specialize, but you don't ever stop doing all of those things that, you know, fill your soul and your being. So, I see that we have a terrific amount of potential. We have all of the information. All of the experts have told us what we need to do. We have models out there in Finland and in Korea, you know, as you're saying. We know how to do it. And it isn't really a question of not having the money. It's a question of not having the will.
No, that's true. And I think you're right. The battle is that we know from scientific research that physical activity leads to brain development. We know that music helps with mathematical thinking. It's been proven. So why do they continue to eliminate arts and sports from schools when those are the very things that help children in a variety of ways, you know, keeping them healthy, giving them a natural outlet for their energy,
right,
to keep their behavior. You know, it just seems like they're like continually crippling education by taking away those aspects that really are the most helpful, and then refusing to deal with, you know, most early childhood educators certainly are aware of the fact that if your child comes in and hasn't had enough rest or isn't well fed or doesn't have nutrition, even hasn't had enough water, you know, isn't getting enough fresh air. I mean, these are things that are going to be huge barriers and cause tremendous amounts of behavioral
right.
problems. So, you know, we think in terms of education that it has to be all about curriculum
yeah.
or methodology or ideology, when really a lot of it has to do with biology.
Right, it's biology.
Just making sure that, you know, and a lot of that has to do with some time outdoors. You know, and you know what? Kids are going to get dirty. They're going to get hurt. That's part of life. That's part of education, is learning what's safe and what's not safe.
Right.
And yet, what I think it comes down to is economics of maybe teacher ratios or risk management in terms of, you know, insurance and all of that. And it's difficult for people to, there are a lot of people, a lot of good people that would love to have their own Montessori schools, and they're facing those economic things, the cost of tooling up, the cost of risk management, you know, all of the things that need to be factored in. And so I hear what you're saying about the courage to do it, but I don't know if those people, it's necessarily a lack of courage as much as just some plain, cold, hard economic facts.
Uh-huh. Well, that I realize,
you know.
Yeah, I think I'm just old enough that, you know, I know that when we moved to California, I've said this so many times, my listeners are probably going to go, not that again, Athena, but when we moved to California to go to graduate school, we moved to California because their education system was second only to New York, and it was free all the way through university.
Sure.
And it was fantastic. So we know how to do this. We know how to do this. It was dismantled in the 80s when it became a business instead of part of the caring profession. Now, perhaps it wasn't done on purpose, but I can't help thinking about Jim Crow and how, you know, there was such effort put into not educating people of color, not educating the masses. Education was only for the elite. And this is what is happening again. You and I, we made sure our children, you're making sure your children are getting their needs met. You're making sure your children have the best environment you can find for their education. I did the same thing. But people who don't know, parents who don't know, they can opt out of the testing. Parents who are accepting without question that the state can do what they want with their children.
Sure.
It's maddening to me.
I think that's the key. I think information, which is why your show and your website are so important, is getting information out to everybody about that type of thing. You know, with Froebel, it's a lot like with with foodie, so you don't have health insurance. Okay, that's not good. But if you eat healthy, if you know, eating healthy doesn't necessarily have to be more expensive, but you have to educate yourself as to what foods. And for the most part, food is medicine.
Yes.
There are a lot of foods, you know, like superfoods and all that. So, you know, if you don't have the resources, you can still live your life a little smarter, you know, eat a little smarter, that type of thing. And I think the same is true with education. There are ways that you, if the school system is going to cut out arts and sports, there are ways that you can counteract that.
Yes, there are.
And a lot of people are opting to homeschool, and I understand that as well. So, yeah, I know what you're saying about the tide turning. In fact, there's an interesting story I'll tell you quickly. There was the Bureau of Indian Affairs, and W.N. Heilman was put in charge of education of Native Americans. And had set up a process, as he was very active in tribal education. His idea was, and he was correct, that Native American education is very similar to tribal education. So he felt it would be a perfect fit. And so he had this whole system in place, and at the very last minute, the government decided to completely eradicate that. So that whole thing was shot down. Now, that's a very clear example of some sort of a, you know, I don't want to say conspiracy, because it wasn't hidden in any way.
No.
A very overt attempt to deny a certain part of the population from having that. What a wonderful thing it would have been. But there are great examples. In fact, I just posted a photo on the Froebel USA Facebook page of an African-American Froebel kindergarten from 1899.
Uh-huh.
So, again, one of those situations where, you know, because they had access to the information about it and, you know, a certain amount of materials, I'm sure it wasn't quite as a nice setup as it would have been in Manhattan or it would have been in Boston or even San Francisco. But access to that type of education, I think, probably played a great role. And I would love, there's so many different doctoral dissertations in this interview. There's so many different things out there that I would love to be able to research and to know conclusively, you know, did Orff have a tribal education? You know, what is the role of tribal education in African-American schooling in the late 19th century? Some of it might seem a little bit esoteric to people, but these are things that had profound impact on American culture, but probably the world. And they're not known. People didn't really pay attention. I mean, think about this. This is a thing that I talk about quite a bit. When you meet somebody and they seem to be very intelligent, you find out where did they go to university. Oh, you went to MIT. Oh, great. Oh, you went to Stanford. Great. Well, yeah, you got into Stanford. You got into MIT. So you were already bright before you went there. So the question is, where did you go to preschool?
That's
right. What
happened
to you when you were 3, 4, 5 years old? That's what I want to know.
That's right.
And that's what I want to know about a lot of famous people. You know, Albert Einstein played with tribal blocks. But we don't know if he went to a tribal school. That's a big difference. We know that he had the toys. We don't know if he had any sort of guided instructions. Now, whether or not that really means anything, because in the toy business, the whole baby Einstein thing is, you know, it is what it is. I don't really know. But what I'm interested in terms of Einstein, nobody really took him seriously when he was in school. You know, he didn't have that type of MIT level education. You know, but he was very bright. He was genius. The question is, what support did he get for that when he was 3, 4, 5, 6 years old?
Right.
That's what I would like to know, but I don't know how to begin to research that.
Yeah, I try to do that too. I think that when I see the behavior of a lot of people in our culture, the first thing I wanted to do is know about their childhood. And because it in my mind it tells you so much, and I know what you mean about that early childhood education. I mean, I am convinced that those early years are more important than university. I am convinced, and it was just a matter of a trust in when I was younger. But I have seen so much now. I am convinced. And so, you know, I tell people, if you can't be with your child and learn the best, you know, and relearn, because I do feel that we knew these things We knew how to parent. And somehow it was lost. And so, you know, parenting skills and following the child, perhaps, you know, we need to learn how to do again, and that, or you need support to know if you're, what you're doing is, will work well, and how to guide and not control, and, you know, things like that. You need a support group. But basically those are the most important, that is the most important years of your child's life. And if you think that, you know, saving money to send them to college and giving them nothing but structure is going to be helpful, you're just wrong.
It's interesting because Froebel, one of the things he did was he had what's called mother classes. And they, in the Froebel kindergarten movement here in the U.S., the Hull House and a lot of these, the YWCA was actively involved in the kindergarten movement. A lot of it was outreach to mothers.
Yes.
And what the basis of Froebel's message to mothers was, trust your instincts.
Yeah.
You know, you know more than you think you know. You know, you're in a society where there's going to be a lot of messages. Some of them may come from your mother-in-law, but there's a lot of messages out there. And what you need to do is you need to trust yourself with your child. You know your child better than anybody in the world.
So, yes.
You know, and that's a very important message to hear, you know, even over and over and over again, because, and it was interesting that yesterday my son, who's almost 17 now, was watching some of the video we shot when he was 1, 2 years old. And lately it seems like he's pretty sure that we have a conspiracy against him, you know, with all the rules and, right? But he was able to go back and see that, hey, when he was little, we may actually have loved him and played with him and cared for him in a reasonably decent way, you know? So I was happy that we had documentation of that. We had some video so that we could show him, look, you know, there were times when we were a little more open, you know? So I was happy for
is
that.
Is he your oldest, Scott?
He's my oldest, yes.
And you have 3 children?
I have 3. Yeah, I have 2 daughters, and 11 and 13, and then my son is almost 17 here.
Oh, that's beautiful.
He'll be at the conference. He helps out quite a bit.
Oh, so. That's wonderful. That's so great. I think that's beautiful that he's going to be there with you.
Absolutely.
Well, we should wind up, as we wind up, let's let our listeners know again about the conference. The Froebel USA 2012 Conference, August 4th and 5th in San Francisco, and being held at
the South San Francisco Conference Center, yeah, which is just south of San Francisco, north of the airport.
And I know exactly where it is. And it's a 2-day hands-on immersion into the original educational methods of Friedrich Froebel, inventor of kindergarten. And there are a number of presenters. It just looks like it's going to be a fabulous time. And if people want to register, they can do so online, right?
Yes, froebelusa.org. Or just contact me through the website.
Or contact you through their website. This has been extremely fun for me. Thank you so much for giving me your time, Scott.
Oh, you're welcome. I've enjoyed it.
And I hope it's just a terrifically successful conference. And maybe I could have you and Carmen on at the same time and you could tell me about it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, of course, you're invited. We'd love to have you there, too.
So. Oh, that's beautiful. Thank you so much for that invitation. Well, I'll say goodbye. Have a great day in Michigan.
Thanks. You too.
Bye-bye now.
Bye.
I so very much enjoyed this interview with Scott Boltman. It was a pleasure, and I'm just delighted that this conference is happening. To register for the Froebel USA Conference, go to Froebel USA website. That's FROEBELUSA.org, all one word. The conference is being held at the South San Francisco Conference Center. It's a 2-day hands-on immersion into the original educational methods
of Friedrich Froebel, who was, of course, the inventor of the kindergarten, as we've talked about in the interview. Presenters include Norman Brosterman, Carmen Gamper, Kathy Topol, and of course Scott, Stacy Willman, John Reynolds, Bruce Rawls, Fenella Schultz, Tiffany Gozel, Bradford Hanson Smith, Susan Harrington, and others. And it ends with a closing by Scott. You can visit Froebel USA's Facebook page as well. That's facebook.com/FroebelUSA. And websites for persons connected to the conference, the Kaleidograph, Kaleidographtoy, kaleidographtoy.com, and they also have a Facebook page, and Red Hen Toys, where you can find so many of the presenter's work, is 3Ws, redhenllc.com. That's 3Ws.redhenllc.com. And they also have a Facebook page, Redhead Toys. You should also take a look at Little Orly, which we mentioned, or I hope we mentioned, an old radio show featuring Dr. Green Jeans, which many of you will remember. And Scott has brought those back and made them available for people. And you can also find Little Orly on Facebook, facebook.com/Little Orly. And Whole Movement, something else we mentioned, and the inventor will be there at the workshop, wholemovement.com. That's WHOLEMOVEMENT.com. And they also have a Facebook page, facebook.com/wholemovement. And Inventing Kindergarten, Norman Brosterman, who is one of the presenters, his book. You can find information about that and other books at 3Ws.Brosterman, BROSTERMAN.com. Well, I hope that some of you will make it to the conference and send me feedback at Hermes@Pacific.net. And if you have any words for Scott, please send them to Hermes@Pacific.net or visit us on our Facebook page and leave messages there. The Education Now Facebook page is a great place to comment and leave comments about persons that we interview on Education Now or broadcasts from Education Now. And just encourage you to have a conversation. We want to have a good conversation about education at this crucial time. You can also visit us on our Google Plus page and leave comments and join the conversation there or on the Facebook page. Education Now is a production of the Hermeneutic Institute for Holistic Health and Education. Education Now podcasts are listed on the American Montessori Society website at 3Ws.AMSHQ.org in the local events pages. On August 2nd, Education Now will feature an interview with Len Greenwood, a 25-year veteran high school teacher, who is the founder and coordinator of the Montgomery High School Green Academy program. You won't want to miss this interview. So, this is Athena Melville saying goodbye for now and sending you all much cosmic love.
Are on the road,
must have a code that you can live by, and so become yourself, because the past is just a goodbye. Teach your children well. Their father's hell did slowly go by, and feed them on your dreams, the one they picked, the one you know.